Thank you for coming, for attending this Dharma Talk. Thank you for all of your help in supporting this community, both by attending, by practicing, and by financially supporting us. We need your help. Please continue if you can.
Good morning. Thank you so much for being here. Sokazan is not feeling well this morning, and he's asked me to give the talk. And he's been having me teach off and on since I came here. I think Michael Stoltz was at my first Dharma talk before we were on Zoom, and he couldn't really call in. And I think he was traveling and teaching. And so I always check in and say, what would you like me to talk about, or what would be a good topic? And oftentimes he'll, why don't you talk about the five skandhas, or talk about a Zen teacher you feel inspired by? And today he gave me a title, which I thought was neat. He, as you all know, he titles his talks. They all have different titles. And so he actually gave me a talk title today, and it's Trap of Believing. The Trap of Believing. Not the, it was Trap of Believing. And this is just an incredible topic to talk about as practitioners, because it really helps us bring into focus some of the contrast of how we have related to our world before practice and how we're endeavoring to relate to our world now as practitioners. And so our entire life, we're conditioned to make assumptions and to create different ways of evaluating and compartmentalizing, making rational the world around us. We're constantly trying to make sense of the movement that occurs in our sense fields. And it works pretty well because we all kind of agree with one another. We would call that a consensus reality. We live in a consensus reality. And when someone falls outside of that consensus, they're ill. They're not very smart. There's something wrong with them. They don't understand how we understand. When we come to a practice like Buddhism or any spiritual practice, it endeavors or encourages us to begin to look beyond just the up and down, the back and forth, the reasonable aspects of our phenomenal world, to see something that Sokazan talks about as not separate. It's talked about as non-duality. And this is where we start to have trouble, because we try to take the teachings and use the same processing mind to get the same sort of results we would get out of our traditional approach to the world. You know, we get rid of logic, we don't get rid of reasoning, we don't get rid of our ability to interact with the world, but there is a certain trap that comes along with these beliefs. There's a certain fixation that begins to arise when we start to feel the fear of groundlessness or spaciousness. That when we sit down to look at the mind, when we are given the instruction to just observe, that's very difficult. Because we want to take that simple instruction of just observing, which is hardly an activity at all, and we want to find a way to believe in it by looking at the mind and grasping at it and reassuring ourselves that we're doing this correctly. So it's a trap, the trap of believing. And I can't help it. I think of that Star Wars, one of those early Star Wars films. It's a trap with the rebels.
With the
rebels, wasn't it the rebels that said it was one of the aliens that says it's a trap? I remember it was a very peculiar looking 80s style alien. So I'd like to look at this a little bit today and how we can begin to address those beliefs that we grasp onto. And it seems that the only way we can work with it, if we take again that same logical mind and try to dissect the belief, we're just creating more and more subtle beliefs. And so there's a sort of vulnerability when we take an attitude of just receiving, that we don't actually have to come to any conclusions or dissect the beliefs themselves, but we want to bring them front and center as clearly as possible. We want to look at them as clearly as possible and notice the impulse to come to conclusions about the beliefs. We want to notice how quickly we want to take the beliefs out into the world to prove a point. That point may be our own self-worth. it may be the validity of the world around us, but we want to come to some conclusion with that belief. And so as practitioners, one of the ways we can begin to investigate belief is by looking at what Sokuzan has talked about as the texture. The texture is always present. Sometimes we become so fixated on the content of our thoughts, the storyline, the actual words that we put to the belief, that we abandon everything else in our sense consciousnesses. We actually abandon the very impulse, that feeling of anxiety that arises when we feel like we need others to see that what we're doing is reasonable. We want to justify ourselves to the world around us, that impulse to explain, no, I'm not a bad person. No, I am a good person. And so one way of beginning to work with belief is to, one, you could, as Sokuzan has suggested, look underneath the label of belief. In the midst of the story, in the midst of the spinning, in the midst of the production, see if we can't flash back into something that's a little bit more primal, a little bit more visceral, which is the very texture of what's coming up and elaborating into a storyline, elaborating into a production. And sometimes this is easy because our beliefs are simple. They're pretty straightforward. They're very logical. We don't take them too personally. But it's when the belief is rooted in our identity that we cannot imagine not pushing that belief on the world. Especially when we think that somebody else is wrong. And so the encouragement is to look closely at that. And it's not that we don't interact with the world and say, you know, I don't think that's the best way to go about this. You know, maybe we should have a conversation about this. But no matter how much evidence you have for your beliefs, it does not excuse us from looking at the fixation that we still have to maintain the belief. And that's very embarrassing. That's very humiliating to who we think we are. To recognize that even though in a court of law, we are correct, that 9 out of 10 people agree that you are righteous and validated, that the belief and the identity is still there. It still needs to be seen. And that reason, that belief, that logic does not excuse us from our practice to look closely at the identity that we constantly reify. I think this can be very difficult, particularly for those of us that see ourselves as very logical, pretty rational, not too emotional. Well, why would I have to look at anything? I'm correct. It's that very statement, I'm correct, that is what we need to look at, because it's still about needing to be somebody somewhere doing something. And the teachings around this become more and more difficult. And I think Sokuzan's ability to interact with us is a prime example of that, because sometimes he's not reasonable.
Sorry.
And I would say to that, so what? That works in your job, that maybe works in your relationships, but when you've asked somebody to point at something you can't see yet, but you need to see for yourself, but you can't see yet, you invite them to use the means necessary to point out the fixation. So when somebody is unreasonable, and again, I say unreasonable just from a very mundane, relative, evidence-based standpoint, it is our opportunity to see the impulse to defend ourselves, the impulse to correct. I have a very strong impulse around defensiveness, around correction. I sometimes step into a dangerous zone thinking I should correct Sokuzan. It's terrifying. He's usually quite considerate and patient with me around that. But as we move into our spiritual path and our spiritual practice, as our relationship to our Sangha evolves and the relationship to the teachings evolve and our relationship to Sokuzan evolves, it's something that we should consider, that we are asking to be challenged. We're not asking to use Buddhism to acquire more evidence for our existence and the validity of our beliefs and ideas. What was the first word of the talk again?
Trap.
Trap. Thank you. I keep somebody, oh, I won't say who, said trust in the belief. And I have that like in my mind. So the trap of belief. So as we move into these relationships, we should continue to acknowledge what Sokuzan has emphasized continuously for the last few years, which is intention. We didn't come here just to feel good about ourselves, although there is some relief, there is support, I think, in having Sangha. There is some support, that's why we call it refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. But that refuge is intended to kind of undermine our ideas about who we are. And so that type of insight doesn't come painlessly. So when we receive a teaching, we start off with the teacher who we've given permission. We've said, will you please function as my teacher? Most of us have done so in a formal sense, and others do so just by showing up and putting yourself in a position to be with the teacher. Be very considerate of any evaluation you may have around that, because while relatively it may be correct, and you may need to say something about it, don't look away from the very identity. Don't look away from the very position that we are arguing from. Because in order to argue, we have to have a position. Unless you're just a contrarian, like a Rumi sometimes. He doesn't argue from a position other than, I don't want to go along with you. It's just exploration and experimentation of five-year-old defiance and identity. We can also, as our practice evolves, you could say, endeavor to take a similar attitude towards the world, because Buddhism can't just function in isolation. If Buddhism becomes isolated from our world, it's really just self-serving. It has to extend itself into the world. And so we start with the teacher, and the teacher gives us trouble, creates havoc, and we have an opportunity to say thank you. Thank you for showing where my fixation is. It begins to get harder when it's the people we've not given permission to that start to cause trouble in our lives, and we want to fight with them. And again, not to say we don't say something or have a conversation. It's not, I often say, it's not like a martyr mentality, like, oh, I'll just sacrifice myself to your negativity and insanity. But to look at, in the midst of those mundane interactions we have, how we still want to take a standpoint, that there are people in the Sangha we feel closer to and less close to, but all of them are endeavoring to point at the same thing for us, even though they're not doing so consciously. Everything, in a sense, is endeavoring to point at that. We start with the teacher, and we begin to expose ourselves in that raw quality to the world. I think it's important, again, to emphasize we are not talking about some form of stupidity. We're not talking about a form of ignorance. We're not talking about some sort of self-sacrifice where we just let the world rip us to shreds. It's okay to remove ourselves from certain situations or relationships. Or my example is, after we get done with forms, often I turn my phone on Do Not Disturb and I turn the TV on. And I need that sometimes. An hour of baseball or an hour of, you know, whatever, watching Three Body Problem. We'd really like that right now. So the trap of belief is not to say that we do away with belief. We're not saying that belief is just this awful negative obstacle on the path. Because if we do that, then we say, well, the belief is real. We can only function clearly when we have no belief. But it's that constant refrain of the awareness of the belief itself. We want to look very closely at the belief and the tremendous amount of emotion and energy that backs up and reifies that belief. It's, to me, one of the biggest things to work with is how we want to take our emotions for the level of validity. It's like the more emotion we have around a belief, the more valid it is, because I feel it. I know it in my heart. I know it in my gut. And maybe that's true. Maybe there's some intuition there, but there's still a lot of positionality that has to occur for us to translate that into our actions and our words and our relationships to the world. Sokuzan talks about no reference point or groundlessness or spaciousness or an open dimension. And if you're finding anything to use as ammunition or anything to find stability or seed on, we're still needing to look more closely at what that is that Sokazan's pointing at as referencelessness. So before I take questions, I would just bring it back to that simple, simple thing that Sokazan instructs us in on a daily basis. It is the intention to train our mind. It's not the intention to see results from mind training, but that very intention to have the vulnerability to just sit down and hold still. And everything continues to function. I really liked, we read out of the meditation primer today before we sat. And he said something along the lines of, even if you can't hold the body very still, you seem to be able to create the intention or the mentality or the mindset to hold the body very still. So I love that. He says, hold still. But even if you can't, because you can't, maybe you can have the mindset to hold still and watch what occurs. And so meditation is this wonderful opportunity to see that we don't have to produce, and yet production still occurs. So we don't have to get rid of the production, but we have an opportunity to simplify our lives for 30 minutes or an hour or 4 hours to see that production more clearly, and see when we don't indulge the production, our world doesn't come to an end. Sometimes we win the fights in our mind, and sometimes we lose, and it does not matter. Most of the time, if you're like me and very full of yourself, you always win the arguments in your mind. The best Dharma talks, and I think a lot of the monks that give talks, which is all of them, will recognize that the best talk you ever gave was the one you gave to yourself while you were meditating. It's so true. You're like, oh, I wish I could have a recording of that. That's probably why Sokazan gives us so little time often to prepare for talks. It's just like, I'll just go up there and be sincere and be vulnerable as you stumble through your words. Another wonderful training opportunity that it's not about production. It's not about the result of a good talk or a bad talk or presentation or conversation. It's about the intention. I would take any questions if there are questions at this point. Michael?
Michael Bowing. Sometimes I see the density of my belief and I become frustrated. And then another thought that follows that is I need to sit more. And that seems like another belief and another trap. How can I work with that when that comes up?
My understanding would be that everything you just described is completely valid, and the belief is that there's some activity that needs to be exerted, and that fuels it. And so however elaborate the thoughts become, the first judgment, the second judgment, the third judgment, they happen so spontaneously, there's no particular need to simplify back to something that's like an original thought. But when you say the thought that I need to sit more, sometimes our thoughts can be pretty helpful on the path, and that you don't even have to tell yourself that. You know, Sokazan can tell you that. And you may repeat it in your mind, but I think that that's probably a pretty good way of working with it if this resonates. Because again, if we just use that traditional mindset to traverse the spiritual path, all we're going to do is accumulate what feels good, discriminate against what doesn't feel good, and we've just got a more complicated or sophisticated version of our spinning. And so the sitting helps create a container to see that spinning. So the evaluation, not a problem. It doesn't indicate that you're doing something incorrectly, but you could utilize that little thought. Maybe I should sit more to say, yeah, I am going to sit more, which you do. And you've been coming quite a bit lately. Maybe be a new resident for a second time. It would be great. Further on that?
No, that was all. Thank you.
Nishikai.
Nishikaban. You said that the Sangha helps us almost unconsciously, or maybe a more direct question is how does the Sangha help us see what we believe, specifically when there's no feedback? Often we don't meddle with each other.
the feedback is arising entirely right here. And so when I say the Sangha is helping us unconsciously, it's not because any one of us, myself included, can say something that's really profound that cuts to something for you. That may happen, but it's just a very functioning in the midst of others' confusion that triggers us in different ways. Sometimes it triggers us positively in the sense of it feels like pleasant to be around a situation. And sometimes it triggers us negatively in the sense that we find something abrasive or distasteful. And it really has nothing to do with the other person, because someone may have a very sincere intention to want to help you and say nice things and try to give you advice. And that is maybe very abrasive to you. So that interaction, it's not because they're very insightful, but because it triggers that defense. It triggers that solidification, that locking down, fixation of, I don't have to take this, that it's pointing to our positionality. And similarly, in the sense of the positive interactions we have, it's like that magnetism, that wanting to be more around that person. It's about acquiring or getting something. And that's why I say, in a sense, that everything is doing that. Everything is, it triggers beliefs and ideas and projections and assumptions that can be looked at. In order to take the attitude to receive all that, though, is why I say it's pretty helpful to start with a teacher, where you actively and very directly give somebody permission to function in that capacity. But it's similar that the teacher, and in this case, Sokuzan, doesn't necessarily premeditate those actions, doesn't necessarily premeditate that pointing or poking. It's just by proximity, it seems, and an intention that that can happen. So similarly, you're in close proximity with the residents, the monks, the practitioners, the sangha, the people that come and go from the space. Just by being in proximity and interacting, things are triggered, positive, negative, and neutral. And all of them point to where we still believe there is solidity, where we still believe there's locality and identity. So, Ren.
So, Gren bowing, along those same lines, when with sangha and returning to our intention with sangha.
Yes.
When right and wrong arise, and we haven't seen through self, how can we include and still practice believing that we're right?
To me, the wonderful thing is that it happens simultaneously. Your ability to practice with that does not require getting rid of right and wrong first. It's like you can be completely convinced and validated, but you can still have the intention to look at, what is it that I believe? What is it that I need to grasp onto to reify that belief? What would happen if I lost, or any number of things? But that's why I go back to texture, is that in the midst of that outflow, whether it's outflowing internally as a form of thoughts and retelling yourself the story, or if it outflows externally, vocally, or for some of us, like myself, body language, we can still have the intention to look at that as part of the path. We don't have to feel it. We don't have to like, oh, I can tell I'm really working with this. It may just feel like the burning, sludgy muck mess that is arising and spinning in consciousness. The persistence is important. The returning, as Sokuzan says, is important. So we continue to function by returning to the forms, returning to the teacher, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And I think that that idea of just continuing doesn't always feel helpful in the long run or in the short term. But as we look back, it's like, it has been helpful for me to not abandon that because I didn't agree or I didn't like it or I had other thoughts about it. David?
David Bowing. First off, Shazan, I certainly appreciate you filling in for on Sokuzan's behalf today. You had three strong words: belief, trust, and intention. the stumbling area with me has been, amongst the three, has been the area of belief. And in hearing what you've been presenting, it seems like as though facing the wall, I can begin to suspend that and start to get some separation from that. But once I'm off there and back into the world, things start to tighten up in a way that I constrict back into what I believe and don't believe. And my question is there a way for someone who isn't in a monastery situation, who's trying to conduct this while in the world per se, to kind of manage that transition from the cushion into just the way that the world constrains you into suddenly you need to declare what you believe in and what you don't? Bowing.
I really appreciate that question, and just that you're noticing that contrast is important. And I would say look at the evaluation of the contrast. So you have what you see as a mindset in meditation and post-meditation, and you're trying to reconcile or get one to permeate further into the other one. And I would say that just the awareness of that contrast is what is important to continue to look at that. Because what, as I understand it, what's being pointed at, if we feel that our insight or our clarity is at the expense of something or can only arise when something else is not arising, we're still looking at a form of duality. One may be more comfortable. One may feel more open and spacious, but to look at what feels like constriction and locking down as well. And so I don't know that I would adjust too much, except to look at the beliefs that surround that perceived transition. There is contrast there. But if we are to look at this with the idea of non-duality, not separate, as Sokazan talks about, we may want to look closely at how we see those two as being not just contrasted, but separate, that one needs to be gotten rid of and one needs to be maintained. And that is not particularly comfortable. But also come back to that, from the way you talk about it, it sounds like you are doing that. You just don't need to accomplish anything in that regard. There's nothing to accomplish in that sense, as I understand it. So probably not too satisfying, but I feel very encouraged by what you're saying. And I know you've been participating for quite some time, and just that continued willingness to return here and return here. Just look at if you're looking for results. More on that, David?
No, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
I really want to trap my beliefs before they trap me. So it was like this constant crusade, maybe the last year, of like, gotta get the beliefs. But I'm a little more interested in befriending the beliefs and wondering how I can maybe move into that area.
I don't know. What shows up immediately, you don't have to befriend them at all. It's that could be an aspect of the path where you start to take an attitude of, Sokazan gives the instruction, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I have no complaints about anything whatsoever. You could actually make a gesture of bowing when you notice that, or internally of, I don't know what this is, but I'm going to work with it. But to also notice that, to be trapped by the beliefs or to befriend the beliefs requires the belief to be real. It requires to have some sort of substance that allows you to work with it. And initially we have to work with it because it just shows up so solid. It's just so consuming at times. And so if you're saying, how do I befriend it? The first instruction would be ask Sokazan, ask your teacher. But I come to some of those instructions he's given me, whether physically or mentally, to make a gesture towards that belief, which can be very painful, which is a gesture of gratitude or a gesture of receiving. And again, I come back to, you don't have to feel that. You don't have to make a gesture of gratitude and feel grateful. You know, it is not about the feeling of gratitude towards the belief and the trap and the hooks. It's about the gesture or the intention. But also bringing back our attention, our awareness to the story that we would be better off without them, or we'll be better off once we're not trapped by them. And that, again, doesn't have to resolve, but you are becoming more and more clear about those beliefs. Otherwise, you couldn't ask about them. They would just be puppeting you. Once we start to see the beliefs is where it's painful, because we are trapped by them, but we're not so clear where we're not able to just function out of the space. We're still trying to find a way to not function out of the belief. It's a hard area. I think about when Trungpa Rinpoche says it's better not to start, but once you start, it's better to finish. Because if we begin to have even the slightest glimpse of our suffering, we can't unsee it, but we're also not clear enough not to be consumed by it. So that's where, better not to start. But once you start, if you catch a glimpse of this, it's best to finish.
Now I'm reminded of, in the chant says, if you wish to be enlightened, do not waste your time by night or day.
Mm-hmm.
For years, I've thought, like, that's just like, don't waste your time, buddy. And now I'm thinking, oh, maybe it's don't waste your time, your precious life. And how do you see that?
You're not black sitting through the night? Oh, that's a hard one, because I think any of us as practitioners have probably beat ourselves with that one. Like, I just need to take this attitude that I'm going to meditate 16 hours a day and sleep the other 8. And we just think that there's some number, like a magic number. I come back to the intention, that intention doesn't have to leave us throughout the day. And there's ways we reconnect with that intention, whether it's through a formal practice or just a flashing on the intention. And so do not waste your time by night or day. You can flash on the precious human birth, which we've talked about. We don't know what's going to happen when we die, but we know we're here now. We have a body, we have the teachings, we have the support and the stability to work with this practice, which may not be there tomorrow. And that's why I think it's helpful to work in tandem with the teacher, because that can help give us direction. Whereas when we interpret that teaching, we may turn it into something that we don't need to turn it into, which may be self-flagellation, like just that beating of oneself. So the teacher can say, yeah, you might want to sit some more. Why don't you try to add in a block sit once a week or something like that? Or the teacher can say, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. You're doing great. Just keep doing what you're doing. And there's a little bit of ease in that, because it takes it out of our hands a little bit. We're not turning our intelligence over, but we are giving the teacher the benefit of the doubt to help us traverse the path. So we don't have to do it by ourselves, which can be intimidating, but we also don't fall into the trap of just our own ego interpreting the entire path for us. Bring somebody else, the teacher, into that. Thank you. Myoka.
Myoka bowing. The questions from Sangha on YouTube.
Yes.
Zeb bowing. How does belief relate to ego?
I'd say that they interplay quite frequently. That the first part is the belief in ego is, I think, kind of the foundation of samsara, belief in self and other. I always come back to this. It really stood out to me when Trungpa Rinpoche talked about the transition from what he called vidya, or intelligence, to avidya, which is ignorance. So that first skanda, ignorance form, there's just this initial raw discrimination that occurs. And so based on that discrimination, that polarization, everything else evolves. But it's that initial belief that there is a discrimination. From there, we use beliefs to reify our identity. We use any raw material to believe in a self. We will take anything we can get to believe in an identity, which requires us to believe in the other. Sometimes it's concepts and stories. Sometimes it's just the experience of the senses. So belief and ego very much are tied in. And also, you could say, both very much unreal. So we're not getting rid of ego, as Sokazan reminds us. We're not getting rid of belief, but we are encouraged to see belief and the belief in self as clearly as possible. If it's seen to be unreal, it would be completely unnecessary to get rid of it. Why get rid of something that's not real? You don't need to fight with Santa Claus. You don't need to fight with, oh, it's Easter today. Happy Easter. You don't have to fight with the Easter Bunny.
Milka bowing, a question from Adriana. How does belief relate to non-belief, Molly?
I'm very auditory. Very, 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 very auditory. So I instantly heard Sokazan's voice in my head. And it's interesting. I've had this since I was a little kid. I remember laying in bed and thinking, like, how do I hear the exact voice of my mother in my head, my mom? And I just heard Sokazan say, yeah, not different. They're not different. That for something to not be believed is it's the aggression form of belief as opposed to the passion form of belief. So we believe it, we grasp onto it, passion. We disbelieve it, we reject it, aggression. Both of them require there to be something to push or pull on. Sanho.
Sanho Bowen, can you say a little bit about beginner's mind?
The way I would say something about that, and that's the teaching from Shunryu Suzuki, and perhaps before, I don't know that we have traditional roots, is that we could relate to it as an intention. If we believe that the beginner's mind can be defined by characteristics, it's just replacing one identity with another. So it is the intention to try to receive things as directly and freshly as possible. When Sokazan teaches brush and ink awareness practice, that's something we do here at the monastery. It's very formalized. You use a calligraphy brush and a pot of ink. And there's a way of doing an enso or creating a circle. And sometimes he says, when you hold the calligraphy brush up, look at it as if you'd never seen it before. Well, of course you've seen it before, but you intend to see it. You intend to look at it. You intend to slow down for a moment and to just receive it. And to me, beginner's mind is a similar attitude where while we may not be able to actualize something being brand new to us, it could give us enough pause to look at it beyond just the first impulse to label it or to conceptualize it. Yes, Sanho.
Sanho, Bowen, at the risk of a stupid question,
I doubt
what about
it.
When we do know something?
Mm-hmm. What was that?
What about when we do know something? How do we receive that knowing?
That's not a problem. Just notice it. There are very functional things you know. You know how, I don't know, to study law, I guess. Although you said you didn't study much in law school. Just kind of crammed the night before the exam. I can't believe that. In the midst of that knowing, it even to just acknowledge it is still a temporary relative knowing. It still depends on the conceptual structure that we create for ourselves. It's not a problem to know how to make a sandwich or how to get to the store, but it's not ultimate truth. It can't be used to defend or promote anything for long. Further questions this morning? Michael
Bowing, I just have an observation.
Sure.
You were trapped that first talk.
And now you're trapped today. Go ahead.
I mean, just In my mind, I see this nervous young man.
I was 23.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd call myself a man. My brain hadn't fully developed yet.
But it was very evident. I mean, you even, I think, made a reference to being trapped into having to do this. And there's none of that today.
Oh. Michael, so I like to deflect. We'll be receiving Jukai next week at 3 p.m. on this line. If anyone would like to be a part of the culmination of his 12 plus years or so here practicing with us. Yeah, I recall Sokazan having you talk about the three marks of existence. It was a Wednesday night. I can't recall. He might have been in Traverse City teaching, or he and Unyo may have been in New York, but there was no way for him to, we didn't have the technology yet for him to give those talks remotely. Or it could have been he had open heart surgery that first year. Could have been. One more funny story. I recall a story about Michael where Sokazan had a synovial cyst on his spine, and I've never seen him in that much pain in my life. This was early on. And as you all know, he has to be very, very sick to not come in. I'm not saying to worry, but he was coming in and then sitting in a wheelchair. And he was sitting in front of the altar in his wheelchair, giving the Dharma talk. Quite a bit of pain, but you know, when he starts talking, the energy starts to pick up. And Michael had said something, and Sokazan was like, "Come here. Do you remember when you sat in his lap?" and so Michael's trying to be very careful. He's not putting all of his weight down. I think Sokazan like pulled you in.
Yes.
Michael's well over 6 feet and was a rugby player. He's not small. And I just remember that really vividly. Yeah.
Wednesday nights were different than they are now.
Yeah. A lot is different. Other questions? We just have a few minutes this morning. Go ahead, Sanho.
Sanho Bowen, did you by chance thank and ask for financial contributions, et cetera, today?
I will do that at the end. And Paoshan, I'm sure, will put in an encouragement to please help us continue these teachings. It takes a lot to keep this place running. And so that support is helpful and tremendously appreciated. It goes a long way. Myoka.
Myoka bowing. With all these memories of, you know, things that happen and who we are, it seems like we can get trapped. What do we need to look at when we're feeling trapped by our beliefs in terms of memory?
You say, what do we need to look at when we feel trapped? I would say, look at that feeling of trappedness. The seduction is to take that same logical mind to become untrapped. It doesn't even consider that there's a lack of substance to what we believe as trapping us and the identity that is trapped. And this is a teaching Sokazan has given me many times, but again recently in the last week or so, to thoroughly investigate that. So I noticed almost all of my questions to Sokazan over the years have been how questions. He doesn't tell us not to ask how questions, but what I notice is I want an action or an activity I can take to counteract what I perceive as obstacles and negativity. And the awareness is what he continues to return me to. So when you ask about the feeling of being trapped, what we need to see is not going to be seen by leaving that trapped feeling. That being said, if we find ourselves spontaneously being moved out of that feeling of being trapped, then I would say it's not outside of the feeling of not being trapped. So whatever is arising as consciousness, as sights, and smells and tastes, sounds, touch, thoughts, the very form it arises in is the form that we endeavor to receive it in. So just looking at how there's an impulse for there to be some special activity we can take. That being said, there are times where we're so, you could say, haunted or plagued by our negativity that we do need some relative relief. We do need some way to turn the heat down just a little bit to keep going. And at that time, that's when the teacher can come in and give us just a little bit of a practice or a way to soften some of that, because it can become overwhelming or claustrophobic, or it just becomes too much to keep going. So I don't want to say that you can't excuse yourself from intense negativity either at times. I think it's helpful to do it with the teacher.
Gabriel Bowen. Does belief imply some non-knowing?
The way Sokozan has talked about it is, he used to say that to believe something is to take it as true without any evidence. That there is an assumption that has to occur for us to make a leap into belief. It's not to do away with belief entirely, but yeah, there's an assumption that has to occur. And again, the most foundational one is the separation of self and other. And while Buddhism is not a belief path, and that we are not forced to or asked to believe in anything, you have to consider that there is some degree of belief that this is a valid path. We don't see it for ourselves at this point, but we continue to show up. And a softer way of saying that is the benefit of the doubt, because it's not blind faith. It's not just like, I believe we will all attain enlightenment. I would like that to be the case. I intend to see that through if possible. But I'm going to look at that closely, and I think that that's why it's so helpful that so much of Buddhism initially is very pragmatic. It gives you a very practical practice to work with the negativity. It sets a very practical intention to be kind to the world. And it does so while acknowledging that everything is as it needs to be. It's as it needs to be, and that's not to say that we can't work towards changing it or softening it, but it's not trying to force some idealization that all the world needs to meditate, all the world needs to do this, but that in the midst of the confusion, I can meet the world like that in my own confusion and what is perceived as, you know, the insanity of what is arising around us. So our final question this morning before we close. Go ahead, Michael.
Michael Pine, I'm wondering if the thing about belief, is it the quality of permanence or making something solid?
Yeah, I think you could talk about it that way. Certainly there's ways in which that hold up. Yeah, I believe there's a quiche in my fridge from Michelle that I'd like to eat this afternoon, but I can't say that since you and Rumi haven't eaten it yet. So I know it's not permanent, but I am looking forward to that brief ray of light in this week of eating that quiche. It's going to be disappointing, though. I eat very quickly in big bites, and it's only a little one. So it's like a 4-bite quiche. I would like to extend my gratitude to all of you that have made this Sangha such a rich and welcoming place, that we can still gather together and that you have a willingness to include me in your practice through participating and through your questions. And I would like to thank Sokozan for really planting the seed of the Dharma here in Battle Creek so that this can come together. And while I'm hoping that he will be back soon, tomorrow maybe, to teach, we'll see how he's feeling. And I think it would be nice to end our time together. We often supplicate for Sokozan's health and well-being at the end of our practices. And so I'd like to end with a supplication for his long life before we dedicate the merit. So those of you that know that. Namo Tukoko Chino Roshi in the Soto Zen lineage, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche in the Karmakakyu lineage, the Order of Immediate Light, Queen Srimala and the Mothers of Wisdom, all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, ancestors and heirs, and the Masters of the Three Times, you are the Vajra-like awareness, manifest for all beings, as the mountain, as the Garuda, outrageous and inscrutable. May that mountain, patient and immovable, be a platform for Buddha activity to flourish in all directions and times. Please remain so that we may awaken to true devotion and fulfill our vow to liberate all sentient beings. Om Ah Om Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Om. Thank you all. We'll stand and dedicate the merit.
Hi, this is Chiezan, the prior at Sokokoji Buddhist Monastery. Sokozan offers these talks without expecting anything in return. If you value these talks and would like them to continue, please visit our donate page at www.sokokoji.org. Thank you.